Good afternoon, everyone.
Good
Thank you for joining us. My name is Tahar Khan. I'm a research fellow in defense and foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute. The Taliban has held power in Afghanistan for 1 year now. Yesterday, the Taliban and their supporters held a parade to mark the day. Now, while the United States and its allies maintain sanctions on the group, Afghans are living through a humanitarian and economic disaster. For example, roughly 25 million Afghans are now living in poverty, well over half the population, and the United Nations estimate that up to 900,000 jobs could be lost this year as the economy stalls. Since taking over, the Taliban has made several promises, such as offering amnesty to soldiers who are members of the Afghan National Security Forces, working toward an Afghan Islamic inclusive government, engaging other stakeholders in a transition council, and allowing girls to attend schools. However, the group has failed to uphold several of its commitments. For example, there's mounting evidence of reprisal killings, and the UN has documented 160 cases to date. According to the Biden administration, the group has also grossly violated its commitment not to give shelter to Al-Qaeda by allowing the group's leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was recently killed in a U.S. drone strike, to stay in a safe house in Kabul. This is also one of the reasons why the Biden administration has decided not to release the roughly $7 billion in foreign aids held, foreign assets held by Afghanistan's central bank on U.S. soil, and has suspended talks with the Taliban. Now, what does this, what does the Taliban's evolution mean for U.S. policy? And does the United States have the tools available to push the group in the direction that policymakers wanted to go? And what U.S. interests remain in Afghanistan today? To discuss these questions and more, I'm delighted to introduce you to three experts and scholars whose work I have followed closely and also greatly admire. So joining us today is Mr. Andrew Watkins. He is a senior expert on Afghanistan for the U.S. Institute of Peace. His research focuses on insurgency in Afghanistan, regional engagement in the Afghanistan conflict, and challenges and opportunities for the humanitarian access. He has written extensively on the phenomena of cohesion and fragmentation within the Taliban. And for those who are interested, I would highly recommend his latest paper in the CTC, Sentinel on the Group. And so today he's going to talk to us about the Taliban's current challenges. After him, we have Dr. Hassan Abbas, who is a professor of international security studies and the chair of the Department of Regional and Analytical Studies at National Defense University's College of International Security Affairs. His research focuses on building narratives for countering political and religious extremism and rule of law reforms in developing countries. And so today he will be discussing the Taliban's political evolution and how they came to be in the position they are today, which is the government of Afghanistan, even though no country has officially recognized the Taliban as such. He also has a book coming out on the Taliban that he'll also mention today. Mr. Mustafa Aykul is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute's Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity, where he focuses on the intersection of public policy, Islam, and modernity. As such, he will be discussing the group's religious evolution and how the Taliban's quest for religious legitimacy has shaped their religiosity. And finally, I will discuss why this all matters for U.S. interests and what U.S. policymakers need to do, even if there are no American troops on the ground anymore. With that, Andrew, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much. It's really a privilege to be here with such distinguished co-panelists. Appreciate Cato Institute's invitation. I wanted to start by underscoring a bottom line assessment from the beginning, which is that the Taliban are likely to be in power and remain relatively uncontested in their control of Afghanistan for the foreseeable future. But much as was true during the course of the last 20 years of war, this is not a reflection of the Taliban's strength as an organization, and it doesn't account for the Taliban's many institutional flaws, their shortcomings, and the challenges that they face. It's a relative assessment of their strength. What we're talking about is a vacuum, a political and military vacuum that now exists in Afghanistan. All other Afghan political actors have been weakened, delegitimized, or driven out of the country almost entirely, as much of the former political leadership of an entire generation was during the evacuation and the collapse of the Islamic Republic a year ago yesterday. I think this is a bit of a different conversation, but it reflects that there had been a vacuum that was growing and widening for much longer than many of us observing Afghanistan wanted to admit. Looking back at what happened a year ago, the Taliban transition into government, as secure as they may be for the foreseeable future today, their establishment and consolidation of control was not a foregone conclusion a year ago. As rapid as the collapse of the Afghan government was, the Taliban were in quite a fragile position themselves. They had overstretched in a military capacity in a way that they had really never done in the past 20 years of their insurgency. The Taliban were caught by surprise, so much so that some of their senior-most leaders in the days that followed after the collapse of Kabul admitted that they hadn't themselves, in their wildest dreams, anticipated being able to move into Kabul and take control of the country as quickly as they did. They didn't waste any time, however, and we were surprised and I think in some begrudging ways impressed by how quickly the Taliban asserted their control over the organs of the state. In particular, we have to look at how quickly, though they may have been surprised, took control of state-run media and asserted their domination of the information landscape in Afghanistan. State-run media in the country were broadcasting Taliban programming in the same day, just hours after several hundred fighters of the Taliban entered into Kabul, while they were still rummaging through former government offices. This set a trend early on that showed us whatever shortcomings and difficulties the Taliban had, they were very comfortable with actions to consolidate their control. This plays into a strength of the Taliban as a militant movement and as having waged an insurgency against adversaries for almost two decades. What they were good at was identifying threats, consolidating their own forces, and moving to eliminate those threats. Again, they were accustomed to doing this through violence, through the use of force, often even through acts of terrorism. Something that we've seen this trend continued through their first year in power. Anywhere in Afghanistan where potential resistance or rebellion against their authority has risen, we've seen them follow a fairly consistent playbook, which is to flood the area with their own fighters, to move in, to use the violence that they deem necessary, and to shut the area down. And then afterwards, if possible, to ensue political negotiations. They were able to clamp down on anti-Taliban resistance in the notorious famed province of Panjshir in the country that held out against the Taliban all throughout the 1990s, but in the Taliban's return to power last year, lasted less than 2 weeks before the Taliban were able to claim control. So we really need to learn something from the way the Taliban was able to move and to dominate in a military sense. But it's also important to note a shift from how they behaved several decades ago and all throughout their insurgency. The Taliban have been shifting to what I would call calculated coercion, using not as little violence as possible, but selectively applying and targeting violence. That's both in a military sense and in a social sense, in terms of repression, of political opposition, of dissenting speech. As you noted, Sahar, there are more than 100 cases. Some media outlets and human rights watchdogs claim up to 500 documented cases or more of extrajudicial killings and disappearances. But this is also standing in comparison and in context to tens of thousands of veterans of the former government's armed forces, which have been largely left alone by the Taliban. This is in contrast to tens of thousands of civil servants, whom Taliban propaganda several years ago told us were collaborators and deserving of the harshest punishment, but today have been very pragmatically called back in to man the same offices now under Taliban supervision. So this transition from indiscriminate use of violence to very calculated violence and coercion, I think, is a huge trend of the Taliban this past year. On bigger questions of governance, what the future Afghan state is going to look like, the Taliban have proven that they themselves still don't know, and that they really entered into power without having much firm idea at all. Taliban policymaking has revealed itself to be more and more of a mess as the group has moved through its first year in power. We have to remember that this is a movement that, even when it was in control in the 1990s, never wrote down their core principles. This group doesn't have a foundational text. In spite of several attempts to draft a constitution throughout their history, they've never been able to reach consensus on anything beyond two basic ideas. One is to eject the foreign influences that they believe have corrupted and ruined their country. And two is the very vague notion of establishing a pure Islamic system, which, again, they've never really spelled out what that means. A lot of that goes back to the flexibility that they applied in order to win their insurgency against much stronger military powers. If you were willing to fight against the United States and the Afghan government that it backed, the Taliban really weren't going to quibble with you over what your policy beliefs were. They wanted you to join the fight, and they employed a policy ambiguity to widen their tent. That's led to a really interesting development, an emergence of dueling centers of power between the government the Taliban has established in Kabul versus the seat of power where their supreme leader sits in the southern city of Kandahar. The Taliban call their government an Islamic emirate. The head, the supreme leader, is called the emir. But I also want to step back and again refer to their time as an insurgency, just a moment. In theory, the Taliban's leader is a supreme ruler endowed with authority from God directly. In reality, the Taliban proved pragmatic after the last two decades. In order for their insurgency to survive, they had to compromise. Again, if you were willing to join the fight, if you were willing to replenish the Taliban's ranks, which were depleted every year in this costly, bloody war, the Taliban's leadership gave local fighters a great deal of autonomy. But now that compromise isn't necessary because there's no more war to fight. And the dynamic between the fighters and the leadership is changing. And so we see the emir in Kandahar and the people closest to him trying to reassert the supremacy of his rule over the movement. That's leading to some ideological divides that are growing and a divergence in policy views, again, which goes back to how unprepared the Taliban really may have been to take power. I think that's plenty that we can discuss further on, but I want to leave it there and hand it back over. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for that, Andrew. That was great. Hassan, over to you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity. I'm truly honored and great to see my two friends, Andrew and Mustafa. A very minor correction, not correction, an addition. I'm still at the National Defense University and still professor, but I moved from the College of International Security Affairs, which is an excellent institution, to Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies, Department of Defense think tank. But all that I'm going to say are my personal opinions, I'm required to say. So it is great to first hear Andrew because he has made my job much easier. I'm going to talk about the origin and the genesis of Taliban, but I could not have explained it without Andrew's great insights. I would divide Taliban into the Taliban life into three phases. Taliban one is when Taliban came into being, early 1990s, 1993, 94, until 1999, after which they were, or 2000 when they were ousted. That's Taliban 1.0. Then Taliban 2.0, for the purpose of clarity and ease, is the phase of insurgency. And now I think they are trying to become Taliban 3.0, but they will try to struggle between their identity, their worldview, how they perceive themselves also through the lens of Taliban 1.0 and then Taliban 2.0. What do we mean by Taliban, the original Taliban? First and foremost, they were a product of history, like most movements are, but there's something more to it. They were also a product of history which had gone through, one, a military conflict, which we call the Afghan Jihad. Secondly, also a product of history in terms of the rural-urban divide that was so entrenched in Afghanistan. Third was another geopolitical context, contest where they were regional players which were always interested, Pakistan at the forefront, but other countries in the region as well. They have a huge history with Iran, for example, in Herat and everything else. The Dari language is a dialect of Persian language. The Pashtuns also, of course, divided between Pakistan and Afghanistan. So there was that factor at play. And then there was this entrenched tribalism. So they were, Taliban were a product in a sense that they were, number one, reactionaries. When they came into form in 93-94, it was a reactionary movement. It was also a revolutionary movement. But it had, the reaction was to frustration. The reaction was to total disappointment because they had won the war, so to say, in the shape of Afghan Mujahideen with the religious ideals and religious model against a much, much more powerful world power at that time. And then they saw Hikmat Yar and Ahmed Massoud Shah and everyone else trying to kill each other. Ahmed Shah Massoud and primarily but Hikmat Yar, he had bombed Kabul out of Samadrians. He had destroyed Kabul. So these were the young folks who had fought in that whole jihad or had seen that, and they were looking for an idealism and dream that now is the time Afghanistan will be a pure independent state, religious state, because the idea of jihad had really was something that was inspiring them. And what they saw was chaos. So it was a reaction. They wanted something new. In that reaction, there were two things which we have to keep in mind. One, this idea of a frustrated young person who is his idealism, who all he knows is how to use the weapon. And then for many of their leaders, they were educated from the Pakistani madrasas. Which madrasas? Madrasas, this religious seminary, mostly Sunni, Hanafi, Deobandi schools. There were Shias as well who were part of this, but those are partly under a different umbrella. But the Sunni, Hanafi, Deobandis were a product of one school, for example, Akora Khatak, which is called the Madrasa Haqqaniya, from where all the today's Haqqanis, they got that name because of that. Many people mistakenly think Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan was under the misperception as well that Haqqanis are a tribe. No, Haqqanis are not a tribe. This is a title. Anyone who is a graduate of that school, which was initially Jalaluddin Haqqani, that's how the name came into force. Also a family name in some ways. The point I'm making, these Taliban, when they had come into power, were a product of history, reactionary, revolutionary, graduates of the Pakistani madrasas. And also, one other factor, which is also relevant to the present crisis in the world that we are seeing, many of them were refugees. They were the refugees who were thrown out of Afghanistan during the war with Soviet Union. And they had, number one, intermingled with the militants from all over the world. We know from the former Pakistani intelligence chief, Hamid Gul, who had said they had trained 30,000 people who were from Morocco, Egypt, everywhere else. That's what made into Al-Qaeda. Those were all the folks who were there. So these young Pakistani, come Afghan, Pashtuns, madrasa students had intermingled with them. That's the history which we have to keep in mind. So when they came into power, so to say, in 94-95, there was a lot of energy. They were young, but very rigid. And that's important to know because that rigidity you will see show itself in so many ways even today. But they were not trained. They had no exposure of the modern world in any sense. Today, of course, the new Taliban have the iPhones in their hands and they have a very different worldview because of the exposure and interaction. I was interviewing one person for a book that I'm writing, The Return of the Taliban, for Yale University Press. This is, I was interviewing somebody for this book. This is still 3-4 months away, but I'm thankful for this title here. I was interviewing somebody, a former Pakistani, actually intelligence leader, or he held a very senior position. And I asked him, you dealt with the old Taliban and the new Taliban, what's the difference? Because I'm trying to figure out in theory, is this what we are seeing is the new Taliban? And he said something very interesting. He said, look, the previous Taliban or the old Taliban or the classic old guard, all what they had done was they traveled from Kandahar to maybe Kabul, but mostly Peshawar, Akora Khatak, Pakistan's tribal belt. And he said the new Taliban have seen the world, Doha, Beijing, Moscow. They have traveled around the world, UAE. They have businesses, Mullah Mansoor, the successor of Mullah Omar was killed in a drone strike because he was returning from Iran. And previous to that, he was in UAE, where he was running a business. The point I'm making, he said to me, the general, he said the old Taliban had very limited experience. And the new Taliban, so to say, same mindset in terms of religion, politics, history, inspiration, but they have seen the world and they really like the new world that they are seeing. So but my topic is the old Taliban or the genesis. So they were rigid, very dogmatic. Tribalism had more an impact on their worldview rather than religion per se. And then having that degree from a militant philosophy at that time, the Deobandism originally, which I know my other colleagues know better than me, and they'll correct me, was a religious conservative movement. But what it had become during the Afghan Jihad was a militant Deobandi movement, which was very different from the original Deobandi worldview. That's what Taliban were a product of. Very uncouth, or they were not trained in any modern statecraft. Kabul was, there was no ministries. It was in any case destroyed. But just one example, and then I'll stop, was that when, this is from one of the original works on Taliban, when the Ministry of Finance used to be a big box that was under the bed of Mullah Omar. Anyone who comes to him for money, gifts, some special thing, that's what he would give. There was no modern finance systems that were in place. That is just an example, maybe a little unfair example, but just to give you an idea of the infrastructure, of the setups that they had. No, this was a rural movement, not grassroots movement at that time, a militant movement, reactionary, with a general idea that they want a pure Islamic state, but had no clue. I personally think they still have not much clue about what they really mean by that. But at that time, it was in a very, very early stage. That's where I will stop, because I thought that context will give us some idea into how to interpret the modern day Taliban's world.
Thank you, Hassan. That was really helpful, especially to set up the context, because I think oftentimes we forget that the Taliban, when we use phrases like old Taliban, new Taliban, we sometimes forget what that really means and what some of the differences are. And as you mentioned, and even as Andrew mentioned as well, there are some stark differences that will help us sort of understand how the country is moving forward and also the group itself and how it's evolving. So Mustafa, over to you to talk about the religious aspect.
Thank you, Sahar. Thank you for leading the discussion and for Hassan and Andrew for joining us. I just want to begin with a comparison. I mean, Western audiences and the world in general in the past 10 years have seen two different movements that, you know, with arms, with weapons, captured the part of land and said, we are establishing an Islamic state, right? An Islamic system here. The first one was the infamous ISIS, sometimes called simply IS, or, you know, the Islamic State, which has been, I mean, after long battles and efforts, you know, pushed back and destroyed in its base, but still it has an offshoot in Afghanistan and elsewhere as too, but known as ISK, for example, ISIS Khorasan. And the other one is, of course, the Taliban, so in Afghanistan. But there are also significant differences between these two groups. ISIS was the most fanatic, ferocious, violent, savage group the world has ever seen acting in the name of Islam. I mean, if there's a spectrum of political Islamists or or groups that want to have political action in the name of Islam to capture a state and establish their land. That was the most fanatic edge. And that's why ISIS, with all their destruction, they gave great harm to Iraq and Syria and a lot of populations there. But they were also, and they attracted some souls from different parts of the world, but they were condemned universally, almost by all other Muslims, because their ideology was an offshoot of Salafi Takfiri jihadism. You know, it's a very specific line, which is unacceptable for majority of conservative Muslims. That's why you've seen a global condemnation by Muslims of ISIS. But the Taliban, compared to ISIS, is a relatively more moderate force, which makes it, by the way, more compelling, more appealing, you know, to some conservative Sunni groups around the world, which I'll come in a bit. Taliban, compared to ISIS, is more moderate in the sense that, for example, ISIS would kill any Shiite for simply being a quote-unquote heretic or apostate. Taliban wouldn't do that, you know. They actually began with some rapprochement with the Shiites after their coming to power. But still, there are doubts about what will they do to Shiites in Afghanistan, the Hazara community, especially the ethnic group, which is historically coming from the Shiite tradition, because they still consider them as somewhat of heretics, but, you know, they're not like ISIS. Or ISIS claimed the caliphate, you know, that is a global ambition. Taliban has a milder ambition called, they call it an Islamic Emirate. So they're saying we just want an Islamic state in our country, which is Afghanistan. So in that sense, Taliban is a milder force compared to ISIS. And that is why policymakers would actually find Taliban preferable to ISIS and even potentially as an ally. And that would not be, I think, a wrong assessment. An analogy that would come to my mind from the Cold War would be the struggle between the Viet Cong and the Khmer Rouge. Khmer Rouge was the most violent, savage of all communist groups that, you know, took Cambodia in 4 years, and they committed genocide, one-fourth of the population. So that is similar to ISIS. That was similar to ISIS. And Viet Cong was Vietnamese communists still. Fought American forces, actually pushed them out, liberated their country, established an authoritarian system. But actually, and they fought the Khmer Rouge later. And it was good news that, you know, they defeated the Khmer Rouge. So there are these nuances between these groups that any policymaker should see and not put them into one basket. However, as moderate as it is compared to ISIS, and as evolved as it is, compared to its Taliban 1.0, as Hassan said in his part, in the 90s, you know, they were more violent. They were destroying, you know, statues, and on women, they were more savage. Certainly, they seem to have taken a few steps. They are using more calculated coercion. Again, a good term that Andrew introduced here, but still, it's very concerning for anyone who thinks of human rights, women's rights in particular, minority rights, just freedom of religion and speech and individual freedom in general. And that is because, I mean, the Taliban, as basic concept, is creating a Sharia state and also justifying their power, their unchallenged power, through that success of creating that state, right? So let me try to explain what I'm trying to say here. I mean, Sharia is a legal tradition of Islam, and for great majority of Muslims, it's a respected concept. It's the divine practice. It's the divine law. You fast in Ramadan, that's Sharia. Based on the Sharia, Muslim women think that, you know, there are certain conservative dress codes. You can, you know, choose one of those. But for a lot of Muslims around the world, that is something that's voluntarily. You mean you fast in Ramadan because you believe in God worship, or you have a certain dress code and because you want to be pious. Now, when you make Sharia the law of the land, a state law and one central government, typically what you do is you go towards religious. So what you do is actually take one interpretation of the Sharia, your interpretation of Sharia, and impose it to society. Now, it's very clearly, for example, in the decisions on women. For example, one of the terrible things, decisions they made was the closure of schools, girls' schools. I think they're allowing primary schools, but after that, secondary schools and other education is still banned, and there's no time, there's no light at the end of the tunnel at this point, despite their earlier promises. But for example, another thing they brought is they said a woman cannot travel without a male guardian, right? That's why women are not allowed to get on a taxi and or you go get on a bus and to go to a different city in Afghanistan. Now, this is how they interpret, right? This is a lot of Muslims around the world would say, well, there's no problem in this because the idea that women should not travel alone comes from a medieval time when it was dangerous for women to go around to travel alone. So the Prophet Muhammad's sayings about this was about that context, but it is fine right now. But what the Taliban does is to impose their interpretation on all society. They think music is haram, that's religiously banned, which means it's not that they don't you know, refrain from music. They, you know, ban it to the whole population. That's why this is a religious dictatorship. And I think it will be a lesson, another lesson for Muslims around the world, including very conservative ones, to see that it's not a good idea to have what you call a Sharia state. Because what you end up is one group that defines what the Sharia is in their own understanding, whether it's a form of Deobandism, which is a form of Hanafism, a strict form of Hanafism. And that becomes the law of the land. So you, as a Muslim, you are deprived of your own agency to decide on how you will dress, what you will live, and how will you practice your religion. And also, this dictatorship model has another problem that comes as a part of the package. Because they are implementing the Sharia, they think that this gives them full legitimacy. They're asking the Afghani people, are you happy to be under the Taliban rule, right? I mean, I recently saw a Taliban clip in English, actually, where there was a nasheed, a song, like a religious. The Afghan people wanted Taliban, you know, they were like saying the Taliban is what the Afghan people want. Well, we don't know what the Afghan people want because they never made elections then, right? They never ran for elections in a competitive system and saying, do you really want us to govern? Someone can say, well, they liberated a country from occupation. Well, even in that case, okay, now they can, they should, will they release, will they announce dates for free elections? No, that's not, they assume that because they're implementing Islamic law, their version of Islamic law, that gives them legitimacy. And that's why they can ban news that criticize them. You know, they had recent dictates to the media about all those basically cracking down on dissent against them, any preventing any criticism against them. So I think the lesson from this experience, which we'll see in the years ahead, I think, for Muslims around the world would be to say, well, if we want to be good Muslims, maybe we don't need things like we don't need systems like what the Taliban promises us, Taliban or similar groups, broadly called the Islamists, which is an Islamic state governed by Sharia, interpreted by one group. It is a state that actually gives us just religious freedom, a secular state with respect for religious freedom and civil liberties and fundamental human rights. In such a system, you would be able to be a Muslim in the way you believe in it, not that it's dictated by the government. So Taliban is presenting us an interesting
Mustafa, I'm so sorry, but I think we lost your audio. So could you just see if your audio is back on? Sorry, we won't be, it seems like we can't hear you again. Do you want to refresh and maybe try that? Yes, Andrew. If you actually want to take it from here while Mustafa adjusts his audio, that would be great.
Yeah, absolutely. To pick up on some of Mustafa's points on the Taliban's domination of their interpretation of Islamic law and their belief in their own legitimacy on the ground in Afghanistan, he's absolutely right. This has had alarming effects because the combination of the last 20 years, or to Dr. Abbas's point, the last 45 years of Afghan and regional history, the Taliban are able to point to a few things. One, as I noted briefly, the illegitimacy of all other political actors, all those, according to the Taliban, that were corrupted by their involvement with the Western-led intervention after 9/11, but even those who came before in the era of Soviet invasion, its aftermath, the bloody civil war across Afghanistan. The Taliban point to this history and they say, both because of their own self-evaluated Islamic credentials, but also political events, we are the only actor entitled to rule Afghanistan. And therefore, they don't see the need to consult with the Afghan people and to certainly not include any other actors from across Afghanistan. And that's proven to be problematic because of how much mistrust and suspicion has grown over time, how many acts of violence one group has done to another, one ethnic community to another, the ethnic Hazara and Shia majority community, as Mustafa noted in particular, has often been marginalized and persecuted. And then finally, you have ethnic dimensions to the Taliban's own superiority complex that are layered onto its religious dogma, where the Taliban's leadership still stems from a southern ethnically Pashtun constituency that, as Hassan referred to, has dominated Afghan leadership and most Afghan governments for most of the past 200 years. Afghans can't ignore this, and they can't ignore the way that the Taliban have grafted religious justifications onto a very bloody and political and realpolitik seizure of power and the Taliban's desire to be a centralizing government in a state that has always seen movements like theirs try to centralize their power. Maybe I'll hand it back over.
Yes, Andrew, I agree. And I think another important point that we should sort of keep in mind as well is that the Taliban, and this is something that I think all three of you touched on, it's the evolution of the Taliban in terms of what they're looking for. And I think one of the main distinctions that we see in sort of the Taliban that's operating in Afghanistan today is something that Hassan mentioned as well, which is that they're more well-traveled. And the Taliban actually have somewhat of a foreign policy, which I think has, for some of us, at least for me, has been surprising to see over the past 10 to 15 years, where I feel in the past, they weren't that concerned with getting legitimacy from the international community and even from their neighbors. They were more concerned with being the only leader in Afghanistan. But now we see that they're on this quest to get international legitimacy and international recognition. And this is, I think, one of the main differences that we see from sort of the old Taliban and today's Taliban now. But I wanted to hand over to Mustafa and see if his audio is back on to see if he could continue with his comments. Oh, Mustafa, we still can't hear you. So I will try to get back to Mustafa once the audio is fixed on his end. But really quickly, I wanted to thank all three of you for your comments. I think this has been a great this has been a great discussion and sort of a great summary points from all three views of sort of what's going on with the Taliban today and where they came from and sort of what to expect now. And very briefly, I just wanted to touch on some things that I always get asked on, which is basically, now that the US troops are out of Afghanistan, What does this, why is Afghanistan important for the United States? And especially as, in technical terms, at least, the U.S. war in Afghanistan is over. There are no ground troops anymore. So why should Americans care about Afghanistan? And again, what kind of goals or U.S. interests is engagement with Afghanistan meeting? Now, I think there's several things to sort of think about, but I wanted to talk about two in particular. The first has been this conception that Afghanistan will remain a safe haven for terrorist groups. And just currently on July 31st, actually, al-Qaeda's leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, was killed in a U.S. drone strike, and he was finding refuge in Kabul. And it's raised some concerns that perhaps Afghanistan is going to become a safe haven for terrorists again, especially for al-Qaeda, which is a group that wants to attack the U.S. homeland. And you have prominent voices like General Frank McKinsey, who's basically used this one-year withdrawal anniversary to argue that the U.S. intervention should have continued basically indefinitely. We also have some polling data, and polling shows that Americans are second-guessing the wisdom of exiting Afghanistan as well. Support has plunged about 20 points last August and has stayed around 50% since then. Yet the consensus view of the U.S. intelligence community is that al-Qaeda has not reconstituted its presence in Afghanistan since U.S. forces withdrew, and that the U.S. intelligence in Afghanistan continues to remain strong even though U.S. troops have left. So this idea that perhaps, that Afghanistan and Taliban again will fall into becoming a safe haven for terrorist groups is not really based on strong empirical information. But again, what does this all mean for the Biden administration? Now, I think that it is essential that the Biden administration and Congress create a plan of engagement with Afghanistan that focuses on diplomacy and basic needs. And the first step in that direction would be to unfreeze Afghanistan's assets that remain in the New York Federal Reserve. But the Biden administration announced just yesterday that it won't release those assets because the Taliban was protecting Ayman al-Zawahiri. But without talks and the release of these assets, the U.S. is harming Afghans more. And it's not really changing the Taliban or changing what Andrew, you discussed, which is a calculated coercion. They're not really impacting the Taliban's calculated coercion in any sense by holding on to these assets. And I think the question that's important for the American public to think about is holding these assets really making a difference to the Taliban? And if nothing else, it's increasing more suffering for the Afghans, which is something that we should avoid at all costs. And also just from a regional point of view, if Afghanistan continues to weaken, then it will create further instability in Central and South Asia, which would be harmful in terms of violence, in terms of food security, and also in terms of the illicit drug trade, which I'm happy to answer questions about in the Q&A moving forward. But in addition to creating a feasible plan to engage with Afghanistan, the Biden administration must investigate the failures and deceit of the U.S. war in that country. And this has sort of been one of my own interests as well, is who do we hold within the United States? Who do we really hold accountable for the U.S. war in Afghanistan and all the failings that took place there? Now, currently, there seems to be some appetite for accountability in Congress. The House Foreign Affairs Committee held two hearings on the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan as a way to evaluate its disastrous evacuation in the fall of 2021. And the Senate Foreign Relations Committee also held a hearing on the humanitarian crisis that was unfolding with rapid speed in February of this year. But since then, there have been no hearings. And perhaps, stinging from the politics of the botched withdrawal, President Biden didn't even mention Afghanistan in the State of the Union address, which I found really surprising as somebody who has watched the war very closely. If a 20-year war is ending, I would imagine that it should be mentioned in the State of the Union. That said, while Senator Tammy Duckworth's nonpartisan commission to study the war in Afghanistan is part of this fiscal year's National Defense Authorization Act, I think it's a welcome move. And the U.S. government needs to still have more public hearings on the U.S. involvement in the war there. And one of the reasons why I say this is because it's important for the American public to hold U.S. policymakers and military leaders who misled American public on the war's progress accountable for all the misconceptions and misperceptions about Afghanistan, especially in terms of Afghanistan's reconstruction the waste that occurred, and the rampant corruption that exists within the country as well. Now, the U.S. government has spent more than $2 trillion on the war in Afghanistan, in addition to the lives of thousands of U.S. service members and, conservatively, tens of thousands of civilians as well. If the Biden administration is serious about creating a human-focused foreign policy, it needs to conduct an investigation into the U.S. war in Afghanistan that spans domestic and international issues. So along with this, you know, one-year anniversary that we're discussing and having this event on, instead of just also thinking about the Taliban and their evolution, I think the U.S. needs to also think about its war on, and accountability on its end as well. So on that, as I'm also the moderator, and this is sort of one of the perks I enjoy being the speaker and the moderator as well, is that I get to ask some of the first questions. And so I'll open this up to our whole panel over here, three distinguished voices I was able to invite. Thank you all very much for attending this event and for your thoughts as well. I wanted to ask actually about, from all of you, your point of view on sort of Taliban's foreign policy and their seeking legitimacy. All of you in your comments sort of mentioned this aspect, but I wanted to be a little more blatant and ask more specifically in each of your views, what kind of legitimacy is the Taliban seeking and why, and whether or not they'll be able to achieve that legitimacy in the coming years. So Mustafa, I'll start with you, just because we lost your audio.
Do you hear me right now?
Yes. Yes, you are back.
Audible? Great. Thanks so much. And apologies for the technical problem. What was it? Well, first of all, Sahar, I should tell you that I agree with you that Western governments, in particular the United States, should not punish the Afghan people by putting sanctions on the Taliban or holding the assets, which is unfortunately a policy that's likely to go on, as we understand from the recent statements. Sanctions, are they achieving, right? What's the goal here? When they will be lifted? If there are sanctions what is the end game here? We've seen this before in the 90s when sanctions were put on Iraq, which really only made Iraqi people suffer, children malnutritioned, and we have very terrible humanitarian situation in Afghanistan right now. Whatever we think of the Taliban, we should care for the Afghan children who are not finding food and people just bred to eat and malnutrition. According to international figures by UN and other agencies, like, there are more than a million malnutritioned children right now. So I believe troubling as the Taliban is, both in terms of its human rights record and its international, its place in the international scene, there should be an engagement, and care for the Afghan people should be a priority, I think, for Western governments. And sanctions without, you know, concern for the humanitarian situation is just not a good policy. It's neither helpful nor conscientious, I think. Regarding international, the international scene, I just checked the numbers. I mean, who the Taliban have been talking to, you know, how many diplomatic relations and meetings, and China is the number one factor, followed by Turkey and Pakistan in terms of engagement with the Taliban. And I think Taliban is, in following with Pakistan to some extent, will try to attract some Chinese investment and some strategic maybe relationship with China, which is also very curious, explains that they have not said anything on the persecution of Uyghurs. I mean, if they're an Islamic Emirate caring for Islam and Muslims, I think the genocidal campaign on the Uyghurs by the Chinese regime be concerned with them. But just like the Pakistani government, they don't seem to say anything about that because they don't want to offend China. And I would still be calling for Western governments to keep dialogue and channels open and trying to engage the Taliban. And instead of sanctions, I think the one thing you would want in Afghanistan today is not to isolate it further and maybe only make China the only outlet possible, which will further deepen the anti-Western and the illiberal nature of the regime. Instead, engage and trying to make them a part of the global economy, that will have a moderating effect. Generally, it has that effect. And Taliban, ultimately, as oppressive as they are saying this is a country, it's an emirate, just like there are Islamic emirates, you know, in the Gulf. They also have Sharia in their legal system. So they don't have also have democracy. So this is a bad model to criticize from a religious point of view, from a humane point of view, from a secular point of view. But still, I think engagement with the Taliban would be the wise path to follow by Western governments.
Thank you, Mustafa. Hassan, I would love to hear from you on this.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Fascinating conversation. I have two or three points, and I'll try to be brief. But I'll link this idea of legitimacy and where Afghanistan wants to go and where Taliban, how they view themselves. I'll link this with one point you mentioned earlier, why US is still interested in that. And I immediately picked a book on the side of a verse from a leading poet in the region, Dr. Muhammad Iqbal, which said something, and it may sound rhetorical, part of it, I really believe in that. The English translation of that verse was that Asia is a body of built of clay and water. Afghanistan is the heart in the body. If Afghanistan is in turmoil, the whole of Asia is in turmoil. If Afghanistan is in peace, the whole of Asia is in peace. I really believe in that. What we need to do is to look at the map where Afghanistan is. With Central Asia, China, Turkey, it's very obvious. Every country thinks they are center of the world. But Afghanistan actually connects the regions in a fashion no other country does. Whether this is trade or rivalry between China and India or between Pakistan and India, we have seen the geopolitics play because what was happening in Afghanistan is so central. Second point is what it's very important for US to learn the right lessons. And Sahar, you had said so rightly. Who's held responsible for that? On one day, we were spending not tens of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars. And then on the other day, we have walked out just entirely. Is there a middle path? Is there? Will we learn from how we did? And because there'll be more such cases, if not similar, of similar nature, where U.S. State building, U.S. capacity building programs will do. We spend from Department of Defense millions of dollars on capacity building of our partner nations. We need to really understand where we went wrong in training the police and the rule of law systems in Afghanistan. Because every other day, we'll be engaged with these programs. Just trying to just forget about it is not going to do the trick. And in one word, if I have to say who's responsible, many people are. But it will ultimately, as the president, was it President Kennedy? The buck stops here. The president, the political leadership in this country. If the military was giving them wrong information or intelligence was failing in their job or the analyst experts were not getting it right, the politicians supposed to do it. And all they needed to do was read the cigar reports that were funded by the US Congress. Cigar reports for the last 5-6 years were making everything clear. We were living in a delusion in this country, and we missed on these things. Sorry, I'm taking long, but coming, I wanted to build that to the point of legitimacy. I just want to raise a couple of questions. So yes, Taliban are brute, crude, their human rights violations terrible. Can you think of any other countries where women are facing such human rights violations? I can start counting, and I don't know where will I stop. Are there any other countries where human rights serious violations are happening? Middle East, Gulf countries, where minorities are being crushed, bullied, imprisoned? Is Afghanistan, the Taliban are doing something so unique that no one else is doing? So why the criterion for Afghanistan is different than anyone else? I want to stop myself by saying recognize them and send our ambassador there. But what I want to say that the current policy and approach that we are having about sanctions and about expectations is there's no precedent of that. And that's why we need to reconfigure and give them some incentives, try to push them because what Andrew had so rightly said, and I'll close with that, there are conflicting opinions. There are people among the Taliban. We know of Mullah Baradar. We know of some new accounts that have started coming in. We know what Stanak Zaid thought. we know what the people in Doha that we talked to and we empowered and facilitated, some of them were, I'll not call them liberal or progressives, but they were very open to conversations, dialogue, engagement. And what can we do to think of new things that empower them? I mean, that will be one way to look at these issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Hassan. That was great. Andrew, would you like to weigh in?
Absolutely. Thank you. I want to push just a bit on Dr. Abbas's comments. I agree with him in many ways, including on the need he and Mustafa touched on for engagement from Western countries with the Taliban as the new political reality in a country that's vital to Asia, that is the heart of Asia, as he poetically reminded us. I would say that in spite of the many problematic regimes that the United States deals with diplomatically and around the world, there is a unique severity to the way that the Taliban has imposed gender-based restrictions in Afghanistan. Nowhere else in the world do we see edicts handed down that deny a fundamental right to education. Nowhere else in the world do we see restrictions on women's access to the public sphere, whether that's to jobs or, as Mustafa noted earlier, to simply travel of their own volition. Yes, there are countries where restrictions on women are quite severe and where women are punished by both state and society, but we do hope and expect and encourage the states that we engage with to move in the right direction. And of course, the Taliban have been moving in nothing but the wrong direction since they took power a year ago. I don't think that that changes the calculus that we all seem to agree on, that engagement is necessary. The country of Afghanistan is important to regional stability and security. And as several of you have noted, I think there's an argument to be made that the United States should care about Afghanistan because of who Afghanistan's neighbors are and how much they care about Afghanistan and how central it is to the national interest of Iran, Russia, China, not just adversarial powers, but also allies and partners of ours, India, Pakistan, Central Asian states, and others. So yes, there's plenty of reason at a geostrategic level to stay plugged in, to watch Afghanistan, before we even begin to address something, Sahar, that you touched on so well, which is our moral obligation to the Afghan people, this question of accountability of the last 20 years of war, of mismanagement and so many mistakes made during this intervention. And we now have the Afghan people suffering for this, like no other humanitarian crisis or economic collapse anywhere else on earth. One other thing I wanted to note on is to maybe draw out a little bit of how the Taliban themselves have tried to approach their foreign relations, the prompt for the question. The Taliban find themselves in a bind because, as Mustafa noted, their preference and what they would enjoy is an engagement with regional powers and neighboring states, many of whom, like I've noted, Russia, China, Pakistan following China's stead, are not going to pressure the Taliban in the same way as Western states on these questions of human rights, of women's rights, of how they engage with their own population, whether or not elections are held, etc. The Taliban would love to manage a foreign policy where recognition, outside legitimacy and the networks that they build can lean on those states that are more permissive to let the Taliban do whatever they were going to do. The Taliban's problem is that these regional powers and neighboring states are not the ones contributing the external aid, the foreign assistance that is still so vital to keeping Afghanistan's economy afloat and its population alive and preventing mass starvation, not to mention mass displacement and so many other challenges. It is still the Taliban's former adversaries being led by the United States, also the European Union and many of their members, that have pumped in hundreds of millions, indeed well over $1 billion in the last year, just to provide aid to the Afghan people. The Taliban are still grappling with how to approach that. They would like to be able, as you noted, Sahar, they seek international legitimacy, but they haven't really demonstrated their willingness to change much of their behavior in order to earn it. That's starker when it comes to the United States and other Western states. The Taliban have been much more transactional with regional powers. But a year on, and it's still unclear where the Taliban's own internal debate is going to land them on this question of how much to compromise and collaborate with the international community.
Thank you, Andrew. That was really helpful. And, you know, I do agree with some points, Hassan, that you made, and Andrew, you as well. And the one question, I have a few more questions, but I'm going to hold off. And I'll get, we had a couple of questions in the Q&A about leverage. And so I've consolidated them. And the question I have for all of you now is, do the sanctions that the U.S. has imposed on the Taliban, do those sanctions have any leverage? And what kind of leverage will the U.S. have if sanctions are lifted? And I think, you know, some of us have already mentioned how sanctions should be lifted and that the sanctions are hurting Afghans more than the Taliban, et cetera. And so there are a few questions about that. So I'll leave it up to you who wants to answer it first. But the question basically is, if sanctions are lifted, what kind of leverage does the United States have on the Taliban? My own sort of view on this is, I think that currently the U.S. has very little leverage on the Taliban. And I say this for several reasons, one of them simply being that the Taliban, of course, and all of you have noted as well, that they haven't really changed their behavior. They haven't really changed their policies. And my sense from that is that they don't feel the need to change, or they feel that they can continue on as they're going. And so the question within U.S. policy circles has been, what kind of leverage do we have? And I don't see any leverage developing if the U.S. does not engage with the Taliban, or at least have some sort of diplomatic talks with the Taliban, sort of keep that track going. Because without that track, it'd be very hard to figure out what the group is doing and why, and what kind of interaction, what kind of common ground, if any, the U.S. and Taliban could find. But I'm interested in all of your views as well. So whoever would like to go first can start. Sure, Hassan, start.
Thank you so much. And I wanted to go first because I stand corrected. I think Andrew was very right that when it comes to the severity of challenges for women, human rights violations, massive, there's no other similar case. So Andrew, I agree with you entirely. And I should have framed that in that sense. But when it comes to dogmatism, authoritarianism, and challenges to minorities, Muslim or non-Muslim, there are other comparable cases in the region also. And of course, what's happening in not only in Pakistan, but India also, or in the region, the Gulf. Many of these countries are big countries, important countries. They would not like to hear this. And there are partner nations, but their track records are also terrible when it comes to at least minority issues and authoritarian issues. You're, sir, absolutely right about that we have relatively little leverage. But I also want to add this. We have leverage on some of the regional countries which can play a role. And somehow I couldn't mention in detail about the rise of Taliban, this issue, the role of Pakistan. I mean, the role of Pakistan in the rise of Taliban was very clear. It's very well documented. And let me put it for the lack of any other word, Pakistan's role in the rise of Taliban in Afghanistan has been terrible. There's simply no other way to put it. Probably I'm using a soft word. And also, they were deeply involved in not only in supporting the Taliban insurgency in some ways, but lately also, since their rise, the cabinet decisions and others. And Pakistan clearly is a player which is very well connected. It's a vital player. It's an important U.S. partner in the region. They are involved in many things where U.S. has leverage on Pakistan, or can have more, and to push them to do the right thing when it comes to women issues, for example. Also, I think, in my understanding, as was rightly mentioned, Taliban have this Taliban 3.0, for the lack of any other word, is they have a very well-defined international relations strategy, it seems. They don't have a good domestic political strategy yet. They're unclear or indecisive or confused. But on international relations, they're very clear. They are desperate to get support, it seems. And their desperation means we have some leverage for a good creative cause, which is to tell them, yes, the money can be back, or some of the aid can happen, or other. They need capacity building support also. I heard yesterday, probably from Andrew, I'm sorry if I'm quoting you, but borrowing from you, which is that the Ministry of Interior there, Siraj Haqqani, and others are reaching out to some regional countries. They need support for their border controls, better management. So there are a lot of ways we can say we will provide you that, but the status of women, especially those curbs, have to change. So we have that leverage, I think. Thank you.
Yes, Mustafa, go ahead.
Hi, Sahar. Yeah, I mean, on this issue of sanctions, I'll just speak also in general terms. I've observed that sanctions also in Iran, for example, and in other countries, leads to a kind of national sense of mobilization, right? I mean, the regime says we are under international pressure. It's unfair. The international system is unfair towards us. The imperialists are fighting us. That also helps them to solidify their support. That also helps them explain away their own failures as something, you know, pushed on the country by the international system. So I doubt that they ever help, you know, to come to any goals. And also, it is for groups like the Taliban, who take pride in having liberated their country from foreign occupation, it's not also a probably doable thing to visibly, openly acknowledge some change so that the U.S. will officially leave these sanctions. For them, it will look like a failure or weakness. And whereas I think Hassan's point that U.S. can use other leverages through countries like Pakistan, it doesn't have to be visible, it doesn't have to be announced, and it doesn't have to look like a failure on the Pakistan on the Taliban's part. That can be more effective. I think all those sanction mechanisms and the policies and the arguments for them sometimes overlook how the picture is seen on the other side. I mean, when you put sanctions, does it really become an incentive? Precisely because you may have a sanction, you might be triggering certain feelings of national pride and conspiratorial explanation of the problems of that country. I've seen that in Turkey as well. I mean, there's no sanctions as such in Turkey, but the idea of any unfairness on Turkey leads to the perception of that, or any manipulation on Turkey, even it's not generally real but perceived, leads only to only counterproductive effects of creating more nationalism in the country and making the population stand behind the very authoritarian government that you want to push for some good steps, and makes them not take those steps precisely because it is asked for and pushed on them through the sanctions.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think sanctions are, I mean, personally, I think they should be lifted on Afghanistan. And I think we've seen crippling effects on various countries like Iran and North Korea. But this is also tied to sort of the other question we had. We've had quite a few in the Q&A, so I'm trying to consolidate them. And the other question we've had is about the Taliban moderating their views. So basically, the question is, would the Taliban ever moderate their views? And would getting U.S. support make them more moderate? I'd be interested in your point of view, especially since we've been sort of talking about legitimacy and also, you know, whether or not the Taliban, they're here to stay, we know that, but no country has officially recognized them as the official government. I'm not advocating that we do recognize them, but I am curious to see what your views on if the US ever increased its support of the Taliban and what that would mean for the group. Would they make themselves more moderate, or would they become more entrenched in sort of their version of what Andrew so greatly calls calculated coercion? So Andrew, I'll start with you.
Sure, thank you. And I mean, there's a connection between the last question and everyone's thoughtful responses and this one, which works better with the Taliban, the carrot or the stick? I'm not an expert on U.S. politics or the way the U.S. Creates foreign policy, but as someone who watches Afghanistan closely, it seems pretty obvious that at least this administration and potentially the next one, there's going to be a lot of reluctance to enter into a warm, supportive, productive relationship with the Taliban. If nothing else, you know, the revelation that Zawahiri, the leader of Al-Qaeda, was being hidden and provided support and sanctuary in the capital city of Kabul, you know, when he was killed in the U.S. drone strike last month, that certainly sets things back and puts the relationship in one of mistrust and suspicion. And so it's a bit of an academic question, but I think it's still an important one, because there are also a number of European partners and other Western states. I talked about those donors who are investing the most in Afghanistan today. And the Europeans are on a bit of a different timeline on how they might engage with the Taliban. Some of them are already quietly setting up and reestablishing their embassy presence. Hassan noted that regional powers such as India are as well. So the carrot or the stick with the Taliban, the truth is the Taliban have only inched forward on a great number of their incredibly conservative and even repressive social views. The changes that they have made in allowing education and allowing women in the workforce have often not come as a result of foreign pressure or of foreign incentives. They came because things were happening inside Afghanistan in local communities that compelled the Taliban to make a compromise with local communities, with the Afghans that they were trying to work with. And that all came in a context where the Taliban felt like they had a war to win and compromises at times needed to be made. The Taliban might not feel like they need to compromise with the local communities and with the Afghan people in the same way, now that they have a monopoly of force. When it comes to external carrots and sticks provided by outsiders, the track record is discouraging. There's no guarantee that a long and consistent track record of supporting or encouraging or incentivizing the Taliban is going to produce major changes in their worldview or how they treat the Afghan population. But what we do have is a clear track record of the Taliban resisting the stick and of pushing back forcefully. And as Mustafa noted, even building their ideology around a sense of pride that they resist external pressure for them to change the way that they rule and the way that they operate. We don't know how carrots are going to work with the Taliban, but we know how the stick works. And the Taliban are very proud of the fact that they've resisted the American stick and lots of pain and punishment for the last 20 years.
I didn't hear you, Sahar. Do you hear me? We all have technical issues today. You hear us?
Yeah, she may still need to refresh. I don't know, Mustafa or Dr. Abbas, what do you think on this question of the carrot or the stick?
Mustafa, you would
I mean, I agree. Something. I mean, you put it very well. This carrots and sticks analogy is a very transactional thought. You know, it's a language, you know, that's very much established in Western political language, right? I mean, let's use carrots and sticks. And it's fundamentally not a wrong idea. But what is lacking in there is the psychology of the people and their pride and their narrative and their worldview, which will intuitively reject being manipulated, right? That's the whole narrative. Like, we are the most authentic people. We fought the Soviets, we fought the NATO forces, Americans, we pushed them out. We are authentic Afghans. That's why we liberated the country from now. And now for a few pieces of bread, we will not do this, right? We will not take steps. We will not change our, understanding of fiqh. We will still implement our Sharia in full, although it's their own understanding and of course their own interpretation. So that psychology is very much there. Therefore, this cold narrative of here are the sanctions, and the sanctions will not change unless you do these things. And of course, they will not do those things, because that's who they are. I mean, they take pride in not having bowed down and having resisted and pushed them out and so on and so forth. Which doesn't mean that you should not still try to use mechanisms for incentivizing groups like that. But that always works better with diplomacy that is silent and covert, you know, with talks in Doha, maybe with some conversations, or with some Pakistanis maybe being in the way, even Turks or others who talk to the Taliban. That may be, especially most Muslim actors may be more influential on the Taliban than non-Muslim actors. That may be a better way. So I do believe Western governments should use some approach of carrots and sticks, but not in the way it is traditionally understood, as, you know, statements made by a press conference, hoping that the other side will say, oh yeah, of course we'll change our policy because you want us to do so. That's precisely not going to happen because of the psychological dynamic of this relationship.
Thank you, Hassan.
Absolutely, we can hear you, Sahar, whenever you want. So this reminds me of this recent an example. We know that Pakistan sent a delegation of Deobandi scholars, including some of the teachers of the top Taliban leaders today. That was, I think, a way they would probably went for their own domestic reason, because Pakistan wants Afghan Taliban to help them get rid of or tackle the Pakistani Taliban. The Pakistani Taliban were on the Pakistani side of the border in the Pakistani tribal belt. They found sanctuary in Afghanistan, and they have an old linkage between themselves. The most interesting thing is we are still waiting for the real insights to come, but apparently it didn't work. And it was so interesting that why Afghan Taliban would not even listen to their the head of the seminaries, who they'll still need their help, because Afghan Taliban need the Pakistani Taliban more, because Pakistani Taliban, some of them had given them sanctuary in the tribal belt. So in this case, their military need it was turned out to be more important than their ideological connection with the Pakistani Deobandis. Again, this is anecdotal, but that gives us one side. Secondly, so I'm borrowing from or deducting from this that why they didn't listen to their Deobandi masters, and they listened to they tried still to save their partners who are militants, because their needs are military. They want to push back ISK. And that is the leverage, because Taliban is a severe threat at this moment. That is from ISK. And to push them back, there might be some counterterrorism related cooperation. Now, we have to be extremely careful of what that means. Again, I have no evidence to support that, but you never know if there was some internal support that allowed us to hit Zawahiri right in the heart of Kabul. There might be some support from within Taliban. So Taliban need, or some faction of Taliban need our support, or our support means our partner support, somebody in the region, Turkey, somebody else, who can help tackle the ISK or be effective. So that will be another area where we can use carrots to help Taliban. And then in return, you see some progress on issues of our interest on human rights, especially.
Thank you, Hassan. I actually have one last question. We've had quite a few Q&A questions online from all of you. So viewers, thank you so much for listening. And of course, if you are going to be using social media for the event, please use the hashtag CatoFP. And so some of the questions I've had have actually been related to Afghans. And so I wanted to shift gears a little bit, a little away from the Taliban. Not quite away, but you know, just a little away from the Taliban. And the question I have for you is, what happened to the Afghans who helped U.S. forces, and how can the U.S. help those wanting to leave Afghanistan? I'd love to hear from all three of you sort of your point of view on this, sort of what should have been done or what is being done, or just your understanding of that. So Mustafa, I'm happy to go with you first.
I mean, I know a few Afghans who had to leave Afghanistan right away in those military planes that you may probably have all seen photos. One of them actually was the head of a think tank in Afghanistan, who was a think tank dedicated to civil and economic liberties, you know, promoting those ideas within an Islamic framework. But that wasn't safe, so he had to leave, and ultimately he was able to come to the United States. But I know there are so many Afghan refugees who have not been able to get a visa yet, and who are going through difficult waiting periods. I mean, the friend I mentioned had to wait in Turkey for a while, but he was ultimately lucky to come recently to the United States. I mean, those people, I mean, especially the people who work with the U.S. forces there, or NATO, let's say broadly, general speaking, they are certainly under threat. I mean, we see Taliban having these revenge attacks. I mean, like people executing people without any even court. So that has happened to more than a few hundred people. I mean, as the Human Rights Watch recently documented. So there are a lot of people who would be under threat there. And I think their processes should be really expedited, and those people need to be brought safely. I know some are here, and there are people working on it, not just the government, but also colleges, institutions, other organizations, and that's all welcome. But the bureaucracy can be sometimes too slow in these issues. I know from my personal process as well. So it is important that you know, these things are expedited, and the people in danger are brought to security, safety.
Yes, I would agree with that. And I know that the United States had a special immigrant visa, or the SIV, in which thousands of Afghans and Iraqis also had applied. And there's been a backlog on that, which has been really unfortunate. And this backlog didn't just begin last year when the U.S. forces withdrew, but it has sort of continued on. So I think one of the things that I've sort of written about and also recommended is that the SIV process be accelerated. And for those Afghans, especially who want to leave, or especially those who were translators and interpreters for U.S. forces, one of the promises made to them was that they would be able to leave Afghanistan and potentially live in the United States and elsewhere. And so I think, at least from a U.S. perspective, that should be something that the U.S. is a promise that the U.S. made, and they should uphold. Currently, there are thousands of Afghans who have managed to immigrate to the United States. Many are still in limbo. And so this has been a big problem for Afghan families as well. And many of them, of course, are also suffering through PTSD and other mental health issues as they sort of had to flee the violence and potentially be in limbo with their families as well. One of the last questions we have about six more minutes left. So I think that gives us some time for another question. We've had a couple of questions on Pakistan. And I think sometimes it's difficult to talk about the Taliban without having some mention of Pakistan. And this is something that both, all three of you actually mentioned in your comments and in some of the answers that you have presented to the various questions. But the last question is on Pakistan, which is, what kind of leverage does Pakistan have on the Taliban? And what kind of leverage, if any, does the US have on Pakistan in terms of improving its relationship with the Taliban? So Hassan, I'll start with you, since I know that you're an expert on Pakistan as well.
Thank you so much. What I'm hearing so far, again, reference my interviews from my book, what I'm getting the feedback from the Pakistani defense side, military and intelligence, they are giving the impression that they have been taken by surprise. In some ways, the Taliban are not listening to them the way they thought they would. And in fact, on Pakistani Taliban is one issue. There are other issues as well, where there is a pushback. And we know from the previous case also, Mullah Omar, when he had the first time he invited some of the Pakistani diplomats, I think Mr. Riaz Khan had written in his book about, they were surprised how they were rude with the Pakistanis. I think there is a challenge. There is a general perception in Afghanistan among the Taliban also that Pakistan had played a very important role, or that Pakistan and Taliban are very close. And Taliban want to show that they are totally independent, and there is an internal reaction to this image. So that has lessened Pakistan's leverage. But still, if there's any country in that region, if there's a priority list who have the most influence, Pakistan is on top, Qatar is number two, Iran is number three. And with Qatar still, we have the leverage. But in case of Pakistan, I personally believe that the establishment's view is one thing, but Pakistan, through because they're getting importing coal, there's many financial links, many Pakistani advisors have gone into Afghanistan to help Taliban. I think Pakistan can still help, and Pakistan is responsible, for not for United States' sake or anybody else, but for the sake of the region. Whenever there was more radicalization and extremism in Afghanistan, it came into Pakistan. Or when there was extremist groups allowed to operate in Pakistan, they found a sanctuary in Afghanistan. So Pakistan, for their own sake, should act more responsibly, I would say.
Thank you, Hassan, for that. Anybody else want to weigh in?
I just would like to ask a question to Hassan. Did I cut Andrew? Just briefly, Hassan, does the Afghanistan model right now inspire Islamist groups in Pakistan in the sense that that's a better Islamic state than we have here in Pakistan? So the real thing, like, does the Taliban success, or has it so far in the past year, had a spillover effect into the Pakistan Islamic scene in the past year? Because as you said, these two countries are deeply connected.
Yes, the brief answer is absolutely. The Deobandi Sunni groups, especially the madrasas from where many of these folks were graduates of, Haqqani Madrasa and others, they're not only very happy, they think that they have this now additional support and additional strategic depth on the other side in Afghanistan. So it is impacting, and this is going to impact more. And that's a strange, ironic tragedy. If the Taliban in Afghanistan are more successful, it will lead to more power for some of the very hardliner, conservative, and extremist groups in Pakistan as well. That is the reality, unfortunately.
Yeah. Thank you.
And I'd just like to weigh in on that as well. I agree with Hassan, but I think one thing to sort of make a distinction between Afghanistan and Pakistan, of course, is Pakistan does have elections. The current prime minister, of course, is a caretaker prime minister. Prime Minister Imran Khan was ousted in April, but Pakistan still has elections where you get some idea of what Pakistani people want and who they want as a representative, which is basically, a right that exists that Afghans have not been afforded. And this is something, of course, all three of you touched on, especially Andrew, about how the Taliban don't have any desire for elections. And I think they've come out very openly and said that they don't believe in any other stakeholder being part of Afghanistan's political scene, because they are the legitimate rulers of Afghanistan. That's how they see themselves, and that's kind of how the system has been designed as well. Now, this is something that I think religious groups in Pakistan would like to see for themselves, but at the ballot box, religious political parties and religious groups have not seen success in Pakistan at all, which is sort of a separate discussion of then how do they have the leverage that they do. But when it comes to being elected, they've failed in all elections in winning seats. But I'll turn it over to Andrew if he had any last comments about this or previous question.
Thank you. Well, on the United States, you know, unfortunately for so much of the last 20 years of war, the question of what to do about the Taliban often turned into or evolved into the question of, since nothing we, the United States, are doing seems very effective, what could we perhaps convince Pakistan to do about the Taliban? And I think there's just as much history in the last 20 years of realizing that question often didn't lead us anywhere very productive in terms of our policy or pressure on Pakistan either. I think the historical record shows there were limits to how much Pakistan could prompt the Taliban. As Mustafa noted, an incredibly important point about the psychology and the notion of pride in the Taliban earlier, this is a group that is now going to define itself. It's going to create its own mythology about how it resisted the world's only superpower. And part of resisting outside influence isn't just the United States, which it, you know, claims it defeated on the battlefield. It also includes resisting Pakistan. And we've seen the Taliban do that over and over in the past year, trying to convince themselves and the Afghan people that not only are they not a puppet of the Pakistani state, but that they will reject foreign influence from Pakistan just like anywhere else. It makes that question of turning to Pakistan for support more difficult than ever, I think.
Well, on that note, we're at time. And I wanted to thank all of you, Andrew, Hassan, Mustafa, for your expertise and your time this afternoon. For all of you listening, thank you again for tuning in and for asking your questions. I hope that I got through all of them and through all of the main points. Of course, Afghanistan remains on our minds. The Taliban and its evolution remains on our minds as well. And I would urge all of us to not just think about the Taliban when there's an anniversary to think about, but also to think about the plight of the Afghan people, and also what can we do to hold U.S. policymakers and military leaders accountable for the U.S. war in Afghanistan. And finally, how to engage with the Taliban. I think the 20-year war that the U.S. waged in Afghanistan has proven one thing, which is the Taliban are going nowhere. They're here to stay, and that basically means that we have to find a constructive way to engage with them. What that means, only time will tell. But thank you so much for tuning in and for listening and for your support.